Hello and welcome to another episode of Africa's Victors, where we unpack stories found within Africa's history. And today we are going to the Gold Coast, aka Ghana. And this time, I don't need to put a disclaimer about saying the names wrong because I got my bestie's mum to tell me how to say the names. So I'm gonna kill it. Hey, let's go. Yaa Asantewaa was born in 1840, and she was the sister of Nana Akwasi-Frane, and he was the ruler of the Ejisu people. Her brother gave her this really prestigious title of Queen Mother, which made her quite influential. So when her brother passed away in the Ashanti Civil War, she used that influence to get her grandson appointed as the ruler of the Ejisu people. Now, this was all happening during the time that the British were dividing and conquering Africa. And as part of their plan to entrench their authority, they would usually send away the ruler or the king of a particular area. So when the British got to the Ejisu kingdom, they exiled their ruler, who happened to be Yaa's grandson, to the Seychelles. And they also exiled the king of the Asante people. Now, to further entrench their authority in Ejisu, the British Governor General of Ghana, Frederick Hodgson, demanded their golden stool. And that was a step too far. To really understand what's going on here, I think we need to understand the significance of the golden stool to the Asante people. The stool was a sacred symbol for the Asante people's soul. According to the legend, the golden stool came to the people when it descended from heaven in a cloud of white dust and landed in the lap of the first king of the Asante people. This was in the late 1600s. The king's priest declared that from this day forth, the strength and the unity of the people depended upon the safety of the golden stool. Okay, so with this in mind, we can see how much of a madness it is that the British were asking for this stool. They were demanding the stool. As far as the Ejisu people were concerned, the Asante people were concerned, they were basically trying to steal their soul. I'm sure they were thinking, okay, cool, you can take our land, you can take our ruler. Now you want to take our whole soul, like the very thing that makes us be, you want to take it away from us. I think every country or every group in some kind of way has a trigger, something that will tip them over the edge, something that they would rather die for rather than live without. For the French, it was when the king asked the people's representative for their opinion on the unfair tax system and then proceeded to ignore what they had to say. Kind of sounds a little bit like Brexit. For the Americans, it was a tax-related issue as well. I see a pattern here. Like, I feel like people really don't like tax. But jokes aside, I think it's a little bit more than that. I've heard it said that the most dangerous people in society are the people who have nothing left to lose. And I can see that, and I'm inclined to agree to some extent. But I think that as humans, we are more dangerous or even more powerful when someone or something threatens to abruptly take away something we're not willing to live without. A modern day example of this would be Brexit. Let's take Brexit, for example. Before Brexit, or before any talk of leaving the EU came to the surface, nobody particularly cared. Not really. The majority of people weren't talking or discussing the EU, not in their everyday lives anyway. It was the status quo. We had by and large accepted that we were part of the EU. Some people might have agreed or disagreed with it, but not enough for the majority of people to care enough or to complain about it or really even to lobby the government about it. There was, however, a small section of the government or the ruling party that were not a fan of the EU. And so to appease them and to gain more votes, David Cameron, the Prime Minister at the time, decided that in order to ensure his win of the next election, he would agree to a referendum on whether the UK should stay or leave the EU. It really wasn't that big a deal. So after he won the election, he decided to keep his word and gave the people a referendum on whether or not we should be in the EU. And then that was the trigger. Before that, we weren't thinking about it. Now the option was on the table. We as a nation, as a people, started thinking about it. And when the people voted to leave the EU, but the government and those who were in parliament began to drag their feet on the whole issue, that was when we saw uprising and protests, because the people were now no longer willing to live without the thing that they were promised. And that's how the UK went from really not caring that much about the EU to being incredibly opinionated about something in the space of a matter of months. If we go back to the idea that people are most dangerous when they have nothing to lose, we can look at the large majority of people in Africa and say that there are many people who would fall into that category. Yet we do not see revolutions occurring as much as they should, based on the fact that to them, that's the status quo. For change to come, there has to be a trigger. There has to be a sudden threat on something that they're not willing to live without. In the case of Yar Asantewaa, the idea that the British were coming to take over their land wasn't particularly strange, because she had grown up hearing about them moving around the continent and doing just that. When they exiled her grandson, that wasn't particularly shocking, because again, the British were known for doing that. So I suppose she had seen it coming. What she didn't see coming was the fact that they wanted to take away something that, frankly, she wasn't willing to live without. And they wanted to do it abruptly. They weren't going to negotiate on it, no. They just wanted to take it. So, of course, this triggered a conference of the elders. And in this meeting, Yar just felt disgusted by how the men were moving. They were acting like wounded soldiers, that there was nothing they could do about it, and they were about to give up all hope, because from their perspective, there was no way they could take on the British. They had far more advanced weapons and more people and more skills. There was just no way that they could take on the Brits. But from where Yar was standing, she was thinking, wait, so these guys are out here trying to steal our entire soul and you guys just want to roll over and die. So she decided if the men weren't going to do anything about it, the women would. I imagine that this proposal was received with absolute laughter. Within their community, women did not fight. So they probably just laughed it off and was like, "Ooh, girl, you funny." They were thinking, we needed something to laugh about and we appreciate that you provided that for us. But the thing is, Yar was deadly serious. Imagine believing in something enough to start without knowing whether anybody would back you. Or imagine that everybody just thought that you were out of your mind. Yar believed she could do something that nobody had ever done before. But here's the power of having something worth fighting for. She was willing to risk it all. I find myself drawing strength from this particular victor. I can identify with the feeling of doing something people don't believe is possible. The whole mission of Vimoye, the charity that I started, is to make basic education accessible to every African child. Many others have tried and are still trying. Even the UN have moved the goalpost on this particular goal because they realized that educating the world is proving to be far more difficult than anybody could have thought. When I'm faced with the gravity of the task that I have decided to take on, I must remember Yar and her resolve to do what has never been done before, against all odds, when everything was stacked against her. Well, Yar managed to convince the women to join her cause, and they took on the British in 1900. Many women died, and Yar herself was captured and exiled to the Seychelles, where she eventually died. But the Brits never got their hands on that golden stool. What a story. This woman achieved the impossible, but it cost her. There's this verse in the Bible that talks of counting the cost of a project before embarking on it. I'm sure Yar was prepared for the loss of life that would inevitably occur, and I'm sure she was willing to die herself. I find myself questioning whether I've counted the cost of what I've embarked on. But I always find my way back to the words I heard someone say, "The purpose of life is not to simply make it successfully to death," which means the aim of life is not to just make it to the grand old age purely because you didn't actually take risks or live. That's not an achievement. We have a responsibility to actually live life, not just exist. We are the best version of ourselves when we find a cause that's transcendent of ourselves. We have to find something worth living for. Yar Asantewaa's body was eventually returned to Ghana, where she received a befitting burial. Her war was the last major war led by African women. While other nations are still fighting to get their stolen treasure back from the British today, you can find the Asante people's golden stool located in the Asante Royal Palace in Kumasi, Ghana. That is amazing. Well, I hope you enjoyed that story as much as I did. If you have any comments or you just want to get in touch, you can find us on Instagram using the @TheVimoye, Vemoye Foundation. That's it from me today. And remember, Yar has shown us that the reality of following your heart and your convictions won't always be pretty. It'll be difficult. It will cost you, but it will be worth it. Have an amazing week, and I'll see you again soon.